to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. I'm so excited to share with you the conversation I had on June 6, 2025 with Andrew Marinus at Bio's annual conference in Washington, D.C. Andrew Marinus is a New York Times bestselling author of narrative nonfiction for adults, teens, and children, focusing on the intersection of sports and social justice. Our conversation centered on his first biography, Strong Inside, Perry Wallace and the Collision of Race and Sports in the South, published by Vanderbilt University Press in 2014. So this book was published in 2014. It came out in paperback in 2016. And then it's been republished in 2024. And so I have a copy of the republication of this book with a new prologue and epilogue in it. What has it been like to have your very first biography be such a successful project?
I mean, it's changed my life in a way. I'd never really intended to be an author. I just wanted to tell Perry Wallace's story, you know, and for me, this interest in him began when I was 19 years old, when I was a sophomore at Vanderbilt taking a Black history course, and I wrote a paper about Perry, and I interviewed him, just cold called him. He was a professor at the law school at the University of Baltimore at the time, wrote a paper about him for a Black history class, and that experience of learning about Perry's experience as the first Black basketball player in the Southeastern Conference was the most interesting thing that I did in college. And I couldn't get his story off my mind. But it took 17 years for me to get the courage or confidence that I could write a full book. So it wasn't until I was 36 that I emailed him and said, "Hey, do you remember me? I'd like to write a biography about you." And I don't know if he remembered me or not, but he said he did. And I got started, wrote the whole thing before. I didn't have an agent or a publisher, but I just wanted to do this as a life experience, you know. It took me 8 years. And so, like, first of all, I never thought the original book would come out, you know, and let alone that it would have the interest of the publisher to do a 10th anniversary edition. But I thought that was important because there were a lot of things that had changed. The story continued after the book came out. And he changed a city and a university while he was a student athlete, but he also did that by continuing to tell the truth about racism. And that really gained steam after the book came out, which is why I wanted to do the 10th anniversary edition. But having this experience of writing Perry's story allowed me, and especially really, there's another version of this book too, a young reader's edition. And it was going into schools and seeing the power of a sports book to get kids interested in reading that set me on the course to write all of my other books. And so, yeah, this experience of telling Perry's story has led to so many interesting new chapters or developments in my life.
Can you tell me about the class that you took? Did you major in Black studies? Was this just a one-off class? Tell me a little bit more about this class that you took.
Well, what brought me to college, to Vanderbilt specifically, was a sports writing scholarship that was named after Grantland Rice and Fred Russell, who were legendary early 20th century sports writers. But I was a history major, focusing on U.S. history, and then within that, like, civil rights history. My professor was Dr. Yolette Jones, one of my favorite professors in college. We had an assignment to write a paper about a figure in civil rights history that wasn't as well known. Like, she didn't want everybody doing Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks, right? And I had just read an article in a student magazine about Perry Wallace in the first game that he ever played at Mississippi State in Starkville, Mississippi in 1967. And you can imagine, he wasn't just the only Black basketball player in that game, but really the only African-American person in the building. And just the hate that was directed at him in that game. And the writer of the article is Dave Shinen, who's now been at the Washington Post for years. He's a great writer. He was a year ahead of me in school. And his lead to that story was so good that it captivated me. It's what caused me to want to write this paper for her class. And I was concerned that she was going to say, "No, you really shouldn't do that. Like, we don't write about basketball in college, you know, or we don't write about athletes. That's not serious enough academic subject for a university. And so grateful that she didn't say that. She said, if that's what you're interested in doing, that's what you should do. And I've carried a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. I already kind of had it then because I was skeptical that that might be what she would say. And I don't think that sports subjects are always taken as seriously within academia or publishing sometimes, you know, that like this could be a real book. It's not going to just be about how many rebounds he had in a game, you know, or just a victory against a certain team. This is about the toll of pioneering and what it was really like to be an 18, 19-year-old kid in the heart of the Deep South with his own civil rights struggle that really meant a lot and changed a part of the country in significant ways.
Well, your book is a really good example of how you weave a personal story, a complicated racial story during the civil rights movement. As I read the book, I was able to really understand basketball as well. So how were you able to weave sports in and out of this biography? Because I don't really know the game like that. And so when I picked up this book, I was like, well, this is a book about basketball. And it's not, but it is. You know, I come away from it having an understanding of how the game can really prop somebody up, but also his loneliness as a player on a team. Can you tell me about how one weaves sports into a biography? What have you learned as a result of writing a sports biography? And then also, like, what's the difference between writing a sports biography, let's say, and a biography about, oh, I don't know, like a lawyer?
Well, for me, I mean, I think one of the pieces of advice you always get as a writer is to write about like what you really love or what you care about. And you better be obsessed with the subject because it's going to take over your life, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I do love sports for all the reasons that just any old sports fan does, like, you know, beyond the transcendent stories that you're maybe able to tell in a book like this, just for the sports itself. Like, I love that. But I wanted this book to be taken seriously by sports fans and that they would read it and believe that, okay, the guy that wrote this book, like, he gets basketball, you know. But I also wanted it to be read by someone who could care less about basketball and is interested in a civil rights story or just a biography of an interesting person, and they would feel completely satisfied with the book also. And so, I mean, research was a huge piece of that. I spent 4 years on research before I ever wrote a single word for the book. I love placing a story within the context of the place and the times that someone operated, existed. And so that was natural in this book. Perry grew up in Nashville, where he ends up going to college. And this is a city that is, you know, in the heart of the civil rights movement at this time. The whole reason he's recruited to Vanderbilt is this university atoning for its basically the biggest sin in the history of the school was expelling Reverend James Lawson from the university for leading the lunch counter sit-ins. A new chancellor comes in who wants to change the reputation of the school, and he recognizes, for better or worse, people pay attention to sports. And maybe if Vanderbilt recruited the first black player in the SEC, the Southeastern Conference, that would send a signal to the country that this school is changing. So it was no stretch to, you know, to weave together civil rights history, Southern history, and basketball in that sense. They really were connected. Then you have Perry traveling to the cities in the SEC, which were the headline-making spots in many cases of civil rights. So he's going to the University of Alabama to play a basketball game a couple years after Governor Wallace was standing in the schoolhouse door. He's going to University of Mississippi a couple years after James Meredith and the riots that accompanied his entrance there. So it's not a stretch to connect these things. There were moments that really illustrated. Perry taught me so much about race and racism, and you would expect, and he had this phrase that he would use. He said that in life we can all be treated in one of three ways by other people. You can be treated well by other people, you can be treated poorly by other people, or you cannot be treated at all. You can be ignored, feel isolation. And so in writing the paper that I did in college and my expectations going into writing the book, you would kind of anticipate that he would say, boy, like, this idea of being treated poorly was the hardest part, and the death threats and the threats of violence on the basketball court, the slurs that he heard, all the like in your face types of racism. But what he said was actually the hardest part was the third way, the idea of not being treated at all. And that wasn't in Mississippi or Alabama. That was in Nashville on his own college campus, where maybe for 2 hours on a Wednesday or Saturday night, he's cheered for by 15,000 people. And he described it as a superhero slash nobody existence. Once the game was over, he was ignored. The whole social life at the university was based around the fraternity system. Of course, he wasn't allowed to participate in that. He would show up for class, or his other black classmates told me they would come sit in the front row, and they would notice that none of their white classmates would sit in that row with them, or even the row behind them. You know, walk down the hall, people slam the doors. And so it was this long 4 years of social isolation that he said was the most difficult part of his experience. And I've had, unfortunately, you know, traveling to schools or book festival cities today and telling that story, so many people relate to that in one way or another. And so I think that's, you know, it's a basketball book in some ways, and I love the basketball chapters. But like you say, it's about a lot more than that. And finding the ways to weave that together was the fun challenge of the book.
Yeah, you did such a good job. I really resonated with the themes in this book. One of them was forgiveness, redemption, this idea of living as long as he did. I mean, he didn't live a long life, but a long enough life for people to come to the book signing. You got to know your subject in a way that few biographers do. And I loved the part where you talk about him being welcomed back into Vanderbilt, but also to Nashville. I get the sense that he was not super excited, given what had transpired in his past, to go back there. He had some trepidation. And so this book takes on this circle of his experience as a very lonely experience in Nashville to then being a hometown hero in a sense. What was that like to get to know your subject in such a way that you could experience these things with him?
It was incredibly special, you know, and it was unusual that I first got to know the subject of my biography that came out when I was 44, when I was 19, you know, and so he was a part of my life for most of my life, you know. When you talk about this, like completing a circle, I remember when the book came out initially in 2014, our first event together was in Washington, D.C. at Politics and Prose. And he was a law professor at American University. My parents live in D.C. And so it was a warm crowd there, you know, very supportive. We were then about to get on a plane to come back to Nashville and do an event at the downtown library. And he said to me, I think we're headed into a hot situation. And it was December. So he didn't mean the temperature. Like what he remembered was basically his farewell from Nashville in 1970. The day after his last game, he gave an interview to the local newspaper, The Tennessean. The headline was Lonely 4 Years for VU Star. And in that interview, he said he had an obligation, a moral obligation as a pioneer, to tell the full truth about his experience, not only for the benefit of the people that come behind him, but for the benefit of the institution too. Like he still cared about this school where he felt like he had been mistreated. But he said, you know, any person that does something for the first time, part of that responsibility is talking about it so that others can learn from it. So when he gave this interview to the Tennessean and he talked about all of the racism that he encountered, he suspected that people weren't going to want to hear it. White people in Nashville weren't going to want to hear it, that they wanted to just tie a bow on this and say, like, we did it. We had the first black player. Like, what a celebration, an accomplishment. But they didn't really want to know the truth about it. Perry told the truth about it. And people called the newspaper to cancel their subscriptions. They called the Vanderbilt ticket office to cancel their season tickets for basketball. They basically called Perry, quote unquote, you know, ungrateful. And he felt like he was essentially run out of town. Never returned to what he called the scene of the crime. He never lived in Nashville again, yet he still was willing to engage when called upon, you know, and still was continuing to tell the same truth for decades, but it took 30, 40 years for the people involved really to change, the administration to change, the character of the university became much more diverse, not quite as southern, not quite as wealthy. You know, Nashville grew. And so it was a new city by the time the book came out, a new university. And the community embraced him. You know, when we came back to the library, we walked in, and there were 250 people in there, another 100 across the room in an overflow room. People were there to see him, and they stood and gave him a standing ovation as soon as we walked in. That was very special. The book was required reading for incoming first-year students for 2 years in a row, which, you know, as an author, that was cool. I sold books that way. But also as an alum, I was proud of my school that was handing this story of a period in this school's history that wasn't all positive, but was saying, like, we're big enough to admit that. Like, let's learn from it, make sure this doesn't happen to current students. You know, what can we learn from this experience? And then when Perry was, when he was dying, back up in the D.C. area, I flew up to D.C. with our athletic director, David Williams, who was the first Black athletic director in the history of the SEC. So you can tie that back to Perry and his pioneering. The other person in the room was Candace Lee, who was the deputy AD at the time, Black woman who's now the athletic director at Vandy, the first woman AD in the conference. And Perry told us two things that I'll always remember. Number one, he said that it would mean a lot to him if we planned his memorial service and held it on the Vanderbilt campus. And when you think about everything that happened, the fact that things had turned or progressed to the point that that's where he wanted this to take place was really poignant. Second thing he said is that the best way to honor him in the future would be to create opportunities for women. And so even as he's about to die, he's thinking about how can he help other people. And I think he was thinking back to his own mom, who was a brilliant woman, but because of racism in Tennessee when she was growing up in the 1920s and 30s, was not able to go to school beyond eighth grade. And so the only job opportunities for her in Nashville were as a cleaning lady at an office building downtown. He hated to see people denied opportunities. And to think that Candace was in that room, who then becomes the first woman AD in the history of the conference, and it was kind of like Perry's dying wish came true. So, you know, relationship with him from the time I was a teenager till the time he was 69 years old and passed away, it was very, very special to me. And I, when I was working on the book, I felt like I needed to keep a bit of a journalistic detachment from this subject. Even though I really admired him, I wanted to be open to finding out anything in writing the complete truth in the book. After the book came out, I would say he was, you know, I could drop that a little bit, and we became very close friends. I remember the first time he came to visit our house in Nashville, and our kids were very young at that time, but they had always heard me talking about this man. And it was like Santa Claus walked into the house, and they, you know, how kids grab onto your leg and won't let go. And they were screaming, Perry Wallace, Perry Wallace, Perry Wallace. And he was very kind about it, but he turned to me at one point and he said, Andrew, do you have any Advil? I think they like giving him a headache with all the screaming, but it was a very special moment.
Yeah. And he said, quote, I don't have the pioneering spirit. I'm not mature enough to be a Martin Luther King or a James Meredith. I've got my hands full being a player student without leading a civil rights movement. He was a reluctant first. In fact, when he was being recruited by, you know, universities nationwide, he had a really hard time deciding what school to attend before he decided on Vanderbilt, kind of at the last minute. But he was wined and dined by these universities. And really what he wanted was just to have a regular student experience as a student, not as an athlete. He didn't want to major in PE. I found that really profound. How did that reluctance, I guess, translate in your relationship with him and also in this book as you guys got to know each other?
Sure. And that quote you read, he gave that one in the middle of that experience, right? So that was from when he was in college. And like you say, when he was a high school star being recruited by pretty much every school in the Big Ten, by UCLA, which was the best program in the country at that time, he saw this as his ticket out of the segregated South. And he really did not want to stay in his hometown of Nashville. But what he told me was that he wasn't going to trade one plantation for another. And so as he goes on these recruiting trips and he is offered cash or cars or houses, all the illegal recruiting inducements of the day, and he was really feeling that these schools were saying, you know, you're just here to play basketball. We don't care about your academics. That was really discouraging to him, but that's what opened the possibilities of signing with Vanderbilt, his hometown team, because when he came, he was impressed with the engineering school, and no one was saying he didn't have to go to class, but he could also play big-time college basketball, and his parents could see him play. I think that there were a couple reasons why he gave that quote. For one thing, he was a reluctant pioneer. It wasn't what he initially set out to do. But I also think he understood that the sports writers that were interviewing him and covering the team and asking these questions didn't get it. You know, like these were middle-aged or older conservative white men in the South at the time. They didn't necessarily want to hear that that's what he set out to do, that he was there to be a pioneer. And so there was some strategic thinking behind why he would give an answer like that too. The same token, like he grew into this role. So because he was a basketball player, there were other black students at the school that recognized that he had some cachet, you know, with the administration of the university. So when they would go, and this is only 2 years into desegregating the student body at the university when he gets there. So the chancellor would invite the black students in to meet with him and ask, like, how are things going? They asked Perry to lead the delegation into the room to tell the truth about how things were really going. At first, he was a little reluctant about that, but then he grew to embrace that role. And that really progressed over the course of his whole 4 years in college, that he saw the responsibility he had and he began to embrace it more and more and really matured over those 4 years.
Yeah, and he kind of grew into the role, especially, like you said, throughout his life. And then his dying wish was, if you'd like to honor me in the future, the way you can do it is by creating opportunities for women. And we've already talked about that. I want to pivot now to some of the other work that you do. In addition to Strong Inside, you've written Games of Deception, U.S. Olympic Basketball 1936 in Nazi Germany, and that was in 2019. And then you also wrote Singled Out, a biography of Glenn Burke, the first openly gay MLB player, and that was in 2021. You've written Inaugural Ballers, first women's Olympic basketball team in 2023, and then you have a bunch of books for young readers. And I'm curious, what constitutes a subject for Andrew Marinus?
Kind of going back to what we said at the beginning, like you better write about what you're interested in. At the most basic level, it's sports history and social justice. You know, and I, through the experience of writing Strong Inside and adapting it for kids and seeing how I'd have librarians and teachers come up and say, like, this student hadn't normally spent much time in the library, but because there was a basketball player on the cover of the book, like they're willing to pick it up. And now they're asking about, would there be other books that they're interested in reading? And that just felt good. You know, it felt like a meaningful reason to keep writing. And so yet I'm not interested in just the story of a important game. Like there needs to be something about it that transcends sports. So Games of Deception, that first Olympic basketball team played at the Nazi Olympics in 1936. And so it's a way of using basketball. And this is a book that is considered like a young adult book to talk about anti-Semitism, fascism, the road to the Holocaust in a way that a 13, 14-year-old kid might find really interesting because it's got that basketball hook too. How do you get a middle school student interested in reading about the gay rights movement of the 1970s? Well, maybe a book that has a Los Angeles Dodgers player on the cover would feel more accessible to that student, you know. So Singled Out uses baseball to talk about homophobia. Same thing with Inaugural Ballers on the first women's Olympic team, which played in 1976. So this is, you know, a few years after really like the women's rights movement of late 60s, early 70s, as Title IX is beginning to be implemented in the late 1970s. 13, 14-year-old kid might not ordinarily pick up a book about that period of women's rights history, but maybe they would read a book about a basketball team. And so those are the types of things I'm looking for. With the new series, it's called Beyond the Game, Athletes Change the World. It's illustrated biographies for kids in, say, second, third, fourth grade. But it's really following the same pattern. They're biographies of athletes that have done something meaningful to help other people. And I was having these experiences with middle school and high school kids with the other books and realizing, like, I need to get to kids a little earlier. You know, at this time in the history of our country, like, learning about actually doing something to help other people, to bring people together when they're seeing so much about, like, people intentionally trying to divide people or using racism or sexism or any of these issues to divide people, I wanted to get to them earlier. So the first book is about LeBron James and the school that he started in Akron, Ohio, and the fact that he refused to shut up and dribble. And he actually talks about social issues, which when he started doing that was during a period when not a lot of athletes were doing it. Second book's on Maya Moore, who was the best WNBA player in the country, and she quit at the height of her career when she learned there was a man in jail for a crime he hadn't committed. So this is a book really about injustice or two systems of justice and prison reform and prosecutorial misconduct for third graders, you know, but these families are living through that. So why not write a book about it? You know, the third book is on Pat Tillman, NFL star who enlisted in the Army after 9/11, was tragically killed by his own men. Army lied about it, you know, so there was a lot that I admired about Tillman being willing to step up and the courage that he had, but also about his family's search for the truth from institutions that a kid might ordinarily think, well, they would never lie, you know. And then the fourth book, which just came out this week as we're talking, is a biography of Jordan Marie Brings Three White Horses Whetstone, who's a Native American woman who uses her platform as a professional runner to raise awareness of the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, and also has been an activist on like the Dakota Access Pipeline and environmental issues also. And most of the books that kids get about Indigenous people are 200 years ago stories, you know, which contributes to this idea of erasure. And so I was really excited to write a book about, you know, a present day young living woman who is Native American and is, you know, so active on important issues.
Well, this sounds like a full circle moment then for you, except that you are bringing subjects to kids that were much younger than you when you came across your subject and found your passion, which is a great thing. You have a podcast called On the Ball with Andrew Marinus, and I wanted to know what types of things that you talk about on this podcast that kind of tie into your biographical work.
Sure. So this is part of my day job. Like most authors, I also have a job to pay the mortgage, you know. So I work at Vanderbilt University as a special projects director. Our sports and society initiative is a big piece of that. And so the podcast is through our sports and society initiative. I'm interested in talking to people that, I mean, it relates to the books in so many ways because I've interviewed people who are, last week it was a guy that looks at the connections between sports and fashion. We've had people that study the connections between sports and art, you know, or next week I'm interviewing a man who was a minor league baseball player who was one of the few out openly gay major professional baseball players. So all the ways that sports transcends what's happening on the field, you know, or on the court is what I'm interested in talking about on the podcast, which, like you say, really relates to the types of subjects I'm interested in writing about the book. So the book's about. So I feel very lucky that there is some congruency between my day job and my passion of telling these stories. Very fortunate to be in that situation.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for taking an interest in the book.
That was Andrew Marinus talking with me about his book, Strong Inside, Perry Wallace and the Collision of Race and Sports in the South. It was published in December 2014 by Vanderbilt University Press. This interview was recorded at the Bio Conference in Washington, D.C. on June 6, 2025. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellie and Marie Fillengains created our podcast theme music. Carolyn Van Putten is our assistant producer. Sherry Newman is our engineer. And Sonia Williams is our executive producer. I'm producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.